From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The season finale of The West Wing airs tonight. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the show with one of its stars, Brad Whitford. He plays Josh Lyman, White House Deputy Chief of Staff. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has seen tonight's episode. He has a review. Film critic Henry Sheehan is at the Cannes Film Festival. He'll talk to us from the festival about some of the best films he's seen so far. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A jury in West Palm Beach, Florida, has convicted a 14-year-old boy of second-degree murder in the killing of one of his middle school teachers. Prosecutors had asked for a first-degree murder verdict, saying that Nathaniel Brazil planned and carried out the killing of English teacher Barry Gruno. The defense wanted a verdict of manslaughter. Brazil's lawyers said the gun went off accidentally as the boy threatened the teacher last year on the final day of school. The boy could face a sentence of 25 years to life in prison. Human rights groups such as Amnesty International have said Brazil should not have been tried as an adult. Lawyers for Timothy McVeigh met with their client at a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, today. McVeigh had been scheduled to be put to death this morning, but the execution was postponed after the discovery of FBI documents that were not provided to his lawyers. Josh Weichel reports from member station WFIU.
Attorney Robert Nye described McVeigh as in good spirits and taking an active role in his defense.
He said initially that he was willing to consider the possibilities, and that has not changed.
Nye refused to speculate on information contained in additional documents recently uncovered by the FBI or on what legal options remain open to his client.
We can't make any specific reaction to it at this point. Everything is available to us right now in terms of potential legal options, and we're going to pursue them all.
Attorney Nathan Chambers acknowledged the defense team is facing a June 11th deadline and said now is the time for them to work, not talk. For NPR News, I'm Josh Weichel in Terre Haute, Indiana.
FBI Director Louis Freeh told a House panel today that he's taken steps to make sure that his agency doesn't fail to turn over documents in the future. Freeh said he's ordered the Bureau to set up a separate office of records management and policy. Israeli helicopters have again attacked Palestinian security buildings. The attack reportedly injured at least 10 people. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Witnesses say missiles hit police and preventive security offices in Gaza and in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. At one Gaza target, the blast crushed a front wall, shattered windows, and left burnt furniture strewn around. The site was in a refugee camp, and thousands of residents came out of their homes to demand revenge. Israel's army says it targeted the buildings because Palestinians had planned attacks from them. A spokesman said one site in Jenin had become a makeshift factory for weapons. The attack there knocked out the city's electricity. The Israeli airstrikes are the latest in a series of attacks aimed at demolishing the Palestinian security infrastructure. The action has prompted U.S. officials to voice concern at the escalating violence. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 343 points to close at 11,216. The Nasdaq gained 81 points. This is NPR News. Jurors in the embassy bombings trial in New York have adjourned for the day without reaching verdicts. The panel must sift through dozens of pages of charges against four men accused of conspiring in the bombings of two American embassies in Africa. The 1998 bombings left 224 people dead, including 12 Americans. The mayor of York, Pennsylvania, will be charged with the murder of a black woman during race riots that gripped the city more than 30 years ago. Damon Baumer reports from member station WITF.
In 1969, York Mayor Charlie Robertson was a policeman and first on the scene when Lily Bell Allen was killed. She was ambushed after her car stalled on railroad tracks. Grand jury affidavits from a new investigation seem to indicate Robertson gave ammunition to men who shot at the car. Today, he fought back tears at a press conference on the steps of City Hall.
I'm standing here in disbelief as to the charge which they must prove. And to this, I maintain my innocence.
Robertson vows to continue a re-election campaign. This week, he beat a black challenger in the primary by less than 100 votes. For NPR News, I'm Damon Baumer.
The head of Colombia's military says a paramilitary group has kidnapped 190 people. General Fernando Tapias said the hostages were workers on a palm plantation who were seized as they returned home from work. He said the kidnappers appear to be right-wing paramilitaries who target suspected left-wing sympathizers. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 36 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at sodexomarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight is the season finale of The West Wing, the NBC series dramatizing life behind the scenes at the White House. My guest is one of the show's stars, Brad Whitford. He plays Josh Lyman, the deputy White House chief of staff. Fans of the show are waiting to see if President Bartlet, played by Martin Sheen, is going to run for re-election now that he's about to go public that he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis several years ago. The president's staff is waiting for his answer, too. On last week's episode, White House Press Secretary CJ arranged for the president to reveal that he has MS on a primetime network interview. Here's a scene from tonight's episode in which the White House staff is preparing for that interview. They're trying to come up with things the president can say in response to the question, "Will you seek re-election?" You'll hear two voices in this scene. First, Allison Janney, who plays the press secretary, then my guest Brad Whitford.
We'll call them answer A and answer B.
Yeah.
Mr. President, does this mean you won't be seeking a second term? Answer A is, you bet, I will absolutely be seeking a second term. I'm looking forward to the campaign. There is great work that is yet to be done.
Yes.
Answer B.
Are you out of your mind? I can't possibly win re-election. I lied about a degenerative illness. I'm the target of a grand jury investigation, and Congress is about to take me out to lunch. I'd sooner have my family take their clothes off and dance the tarantella on the Truman balcony than go through a campaign with this around my neck. I think that's too on the nose.
I do.
Brad Whitford, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It is such a joy to be here.
Well, President Bartlet is about to publicly disclose that he has MS, and we and his staff are kind of waiting to find out if he's running for re-election or not. Any clues what we're in store for tonight?
I can tell you that nobody knows in the cast. I don't think Aaron has made a final decision yet, and there are actually more ways that this could go than one would think. So there's a big question for Bartlet as to whether an election is viable now, and there's a question I think for Martin Sheen about whether he wants to do a TV show.
Uh-huh. Well, here's the problem. If President Bartlet decides not to run again and Martin Sheen decides he doesn't want to do a TV show, like you and the rest of the White House staff are kind of out of a job, aren't you?
Well, there are a lot of scenarios that could remedy that. We have a very tricky vice president, of course, Hoynes, who we don't quite get along with. Things could happen to Hoynes. I've always kidded Tim Matheson that he's a heartbeat away from a regular. So there are all sorts of things that could happen. It's very funny because we started doing this show a year into our term, and when a show does as well as this has, which has really shocked us all, I think we all thought it would be maybe a snooty little critic's darling. But when a show does this well commercially, they start to look way down the road. They're looking for ways, you know, either we may have to change the Constitution to get to syndication. That's the problem.
Now, you know, viewers of The West Wing get really impatient. They want to know what's happening. What's it like for you, a star of the show, to not know what happens next on the program?
Well, it's exciting. It's the way that Aaron Sorkin, who writes every episode amazingly, works. He works without an outline, which actually I was talking to someone last night about. There's a lot of great material that he discovers very immediately. My whole relationship with Donna.
She's your assistant on the program.
And played by Janelle Maloney. And, you know, Donna was a small part in the pilot, and Aaron saw in the pilot and in the episode that we came back with, he saw in dailies something really fun and just sort of capitalized on it. A lot of shows are very rigidly outlined for the whole year. And then you don't get to make those kinds of discoveries. It certainly makes it exciting. And I can honestly say when I'm interviewed about things like this, I have no idea.
Last season ended with a would-be assassin shooting one of the members of the White House staff. It was a cliffhanger ending, and we didn't know who was shot until the first episode of the new season. That person turned out to be you. When did you find out that you were the one who was shot?
Well, I was, we were shooting the final episode of the first year, and we were at the museum in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., and the way we shot it, there was, you would just hear the shots, you were screaming gun, and there was chaos, 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 and nobody knew who was going to be shot, and Aaron just kind of casually walked by me and said, it's going to be you.
tag, you're it.
Tag, you're it. And then it was very funny because I kept the secret even from my mother, who actually lives in Philadelphia. And it was very funny because when the show, the second season premiered, I was at work and it was about 6 o'clock and the show was on at 9 in Philadelphia. And I said, I just want to listen to the teaser with you, so stay on the phone. And she said, oh, my goodness, they shot Martin because they revealed that the president got shot. And then when it was revealed that I was shot, she said, oh, dear, I have to hang up now. And she hung up on me.
Now, why did you have to wait till the night of the broadcast to tell her? Why couldn't you tell her before?
I just thought that she would enjoy the experience of the show. A little more.
You weren't afraid that she'd take it to the New York Times and spill the secret?
Well, she's got a mouth on her. Yeah, she basically walks around Philadelphia with a sandwich board on her back saying, my son is on the West Wing. So she was not somebody I wanted to tell.
Now, when Aaron Sorkin told you that it was your character who was shot, did you think, well, that's a good thing? You know, now you'll have more kind of subplots and your character will be the center of attention for a while. Or did you think, wait a minute, what if the character dies?
Well, I was fairly confident that the character was not going to die. I was also, it was fairly clear that this was not a good time to renegotiate. But I was actually quite honored by it because it was an important event in the show, and it meant a lot to me that I think part of the reason Aaron did it was because he felt like people would not want you to be shot, and it felt like a compliment getting shot.
Well, your character healed pretty quickly physically, but you became a little edgy, a little paranoid, and started behaving kind of inappropriately. And in the Christmas episode, the chief of staff actually sends in an expert in dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome to help you out.
Yeah.
And so let's hear a scene that's an example of why the White House staff was so worried about you. Here you are in the Oval Office with the president and the chief of staff, behaving quite inappropriately.
Can I say I think it's a bad idea?
Why?
It's not something Didion's going to like.
Well, I'm just talking about a meeting, but if I decide to do it, the president controls the SPR, not Congress.
Yeah, but Didion controls the IMF vote.
The two aren't related.
Let's move on.
The two are related.
How?
Through Didion.
I'm saying the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and forgiving the IMF debt are not related.
Anything else?
Of course they're related.
Josh.
If Didion doesn't like that we're tapping into the SPR, he's not going to let the IMF dead out of committee.
We'll talk to him tonight.
Mr. President.
At the Christmas party, we'll take him aside.
No, sir, you can't just take him aside.
Josh, we can move on.
We can't move on from
Josh.
You. We can't just take him aside. If we tell him we need his help, then we give him visibility and power, and we put him in a position to say no and be a hero to his party. And who wouldn't want to do that for a living?
Josh, Didion's a good guy. We can talk to him.
You need to listen to me. You have to listen to me. I can't help you unless you listen to me. You can't send Christmas cards to everyone. You can't do it. Forget the SPR. Let's get the IMF loans like we said we were going to. Listen to what I have to say about Didion, and please listen to me.
Josh.
All right, let's move on.
Josh, go into my office, would you?
Suppose if it's just a meeting...
Wait in my office, would you?
Okay.
That scene is really kind of out of character for you, which is why they sent in the traumatic stress expert. But as an actor, it must have been interesting because it gave you a chance to show a different side of your character and of yourself.
Yeah, the challenge in that episode... was to get a Josh that could conceivably get through the day, who wasn't clearly nuts, but there was something very dangerous going on with him. It was difficult dealing with. The most interesting thing was to deal with his attempts at humor, which are a defense mechanism for Josh, and something he's very, very good at. And in this particular episode, it was very tricky trying to sort of find a way to do his humor in a way that simply did not work. It was very difficult to scream at Martin that way, because he just looked. He looked heartbroken, and I adore Martin. It was a very difficult thing to that inappropriately explode.
My guest is Brad Whitford. He plays Josh Lyman, Deputy White House Chief of Staff, on The West Wing. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Brad Whitford is my guest, and he plays Deputy White House Chief of Staff Josh Lyman on The West Wing, and the final episode of the season airs tonight. The West Wing started in the Clinton era and was perceived as an idealized version of the Clinton White House. Now that Clinton is out and George W. Bush is in, do you think that there's been changes on the script, or are you expecting changes in the series to kind of reflect that there's a Republican White House now?
No, first of all, we were clearly not Clinton. Bartlett is clearly not Clinton. He is a progressive Democrat. I actually think that the current scenario is for the show. This is different from what I think would be the best thing for the country. But for the show, I think that the current scenario is actually the best, because it would have been awkward if we were portraying a progressive, heroic Democratic president in an era where, you know, Ronald Reagan won in a landslide. We would have been sort of anachronistic, I think. But now we're able to be a kind of a contrast. I also believe that I think there's something inherently heroic about a progressive Democratic president. And I don't think our show would work if at the end of the hour the music swelled and we were all you know, jumping up and down in the Oval Office saying, you know, hey, we're drilling on protected lands. you know, we got the huge tax cut for the top bracket. You know, I just don't think it would work.
How closely do you watch the White House, and how closely do you watch your counterpart in the White House?
I watch it very carefully, actually. I mean, I follow in the papers. I have spoken to Josh Bolton, who is President Bush's deputy chief of staff, and I've spoken a lot to Steve Ricchetti, who was President Clinton's chief of staff. In each White House, the roles of deputy chief of staff or chief of staff have many different responsibilities. On our show, we should have a show that has 40 characters in it. There are so many roles in the White House that we dramatically cannot cram into a one-hour show. So my deputy chief of staff, is actually down on the Hill cajoling representatives and senators, and I'm meeting pollsters at the airport. I'm doing a lot of the things that would be a little more farmed out in the actual White House.
I know that there have been episodes of The West Wing that have been loosely based on things that have actually happened. I'm wondering if the opposite has happened, if you've done episodes and then watched the real version of it later play out at the White House, and if so, if you were watching carefully to see how the deputy chief of staff at the White House was dealing with it.
How he was reacting to it?
Yeah.
You know, there's actually a rumor, and I don't know if it's true. We did a thing about the Antiquities Act, where the president was trying to preserve a piece of land, and there were some difficult negotiations with the Senate. At the last minute, I pulled up the Antiquities Act, and we used it to preserve this land. And there is a rumor that some people in the Interior Department sort of picked up on that, and that some of the Clinton antiquities actions were the result of that. But I don't know if that's true.
Has anyone from the White House ever called you up and said you got it right or you got it wrong?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Last night I was sitting with Aaron, actually, here in New York, and a guy from the State Department came up and said that we had gotten a situation, a hostage situation in Colombia, absolutely right. He had dealt with one and was amazed at how accurately we had portrayed the situation in the Situation Room and the situation in Colombia. And that's always shocking. Shocking to us. I mean, what is surprising is the people in Washington have taken it, from both sides of the aisle, have taken it much more seriously than we expected. I think partially because we are not portraying them cynically. Usually politicians are either saints or buffoons. But we're portraying smart people making very difficult decisions. But the other thing is that we didn't anticipate was the power of... we did a show about the census where there was an argument going on between computer sampling and head counts. And this is a fairly esoteric policy argument that most people don't think about. And we were able to get the bullet points of both sides of this argument across to 18 million people. In the course of doing a show that our intent was not to feed America their vegetables and give them a civics lesson, but to entertain them. But in the course of that, you know, we happened to get this across. And people in the White House have said that's an incredibly powerful thing.
What are some of the roles you have that we'd be most likely to remember you for before The West Wing?
Well, a lot of people remember me as Al Pacino's nephew in Scent of a Woman. We have a big argument at Thanksgiving dinner. He throws me against the wall and chokes me. I'm the guy who shot Kevin Costner in the Clint Eastwood movie, A Perfect World, which was a role I loved. It was a guy who, the only time he took a cigarette out of his mouth was to kill somebody. And that was a really fun role to play. I was Tom Hanks' assistant in Philadelphia. And then there's a whole oeuvre of yuppie scum that I played. I was in Revenge of the Nerds Part 2. I was in one movie I've never seen, which is Billy Madison, are movies that I honestly didn't want to play those parts. But it's very difficult because you want to make a living, you want to practice film acting, and if you're a high hairlined white guy, the villains are now yuppies, and that's what I got for a long time.
That's funny. I hadn't thought of it quite that way.
Well, it used to be that villains were, Nazis, and now they're corporate guys who are morally bankrupt.
And how does the stereotyped image of you as yuppie scum square with your self image?
I'm scummy, but I'm not a yuppie. No, with my self image, I pray to God I'm nothing like that. My wife, I mean, when I met my wife, all she knew me from was, she had seen me in a play, and we had this sort of wonderful night, and we talked a lot about how I was raised Quaker, and I'd rescued all these animals, and I rode her home on the handlebars of my bicycle. And then she went and rented these three movies that I did. And she thought she was going out with Ted Bundy. So I really hope that I am nothing like those guys.
Brad Whitford will be back in the second half of the show. He plays the deputy White House chief of staff on the NBC series The West Wing. The season finale airs tonight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews tonight's season finale of The West Wing, and we continue our conversation with one of the show's stars, Brad Whitford. Film critic Henry Sheehan is at the Cannes Film Festival. He'll tell us about some of the best films he's seen so far. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Brad Whitford, one of the stars of the NBC series The West Wing. He plays Josh Lyman, the deputy White House chief of staff. The season finale airs tonight. You're married to Jane Kaczmarek, and yes. She plays the mother and wife in Malcolm in the Middle, someone yes. who's just obsessively strict in her way of disciplining her very wild sons.
Yes.
You each got popular, successful series the same year. I'm
yes.
wondering if you used to worry, you know, what if one of you becomes popular before the other, or if one of you catches on and the other doesn't? Did you worry about, you know, jealousy and how uneven a relationship can feel if one person is famous and the other isn't?
Well, I'll tell you, we didn't worry about it, but we have been remarkably lucky. It is such a miracle to get a job. It's such a miracle to get a job that isn't humiliating. It is such a miracle to get a job that isn't humiliating, that works. It's a miracle to get a job that isn't humiliating, that works, that critics like, and that is commercially successful. I mean, it's just, it really is miraculous. We have so many friends, much better actors than we are, who have not had that luck. And for us both, it was just extraordinary. It was just extraordinary that it happened at the same time. And now, for us to be able to go through this circus together, we realize that it would have been difficult. I think it is difficult if someone is getting so much attention. And it is a special pleasure to be able to go to the functions that we have to go to, these award shows and things like that, together. And it's not pulling us apart. It's something that it's this sort of silly ride that we're enjoying together.
Now, you mentioned that you were brought up Quaker. how Quaker were you? What aspects of being a Quaker were the ones that were really a part of your upbringing?
We were not intensely religious Quakers, but my parents had become Quakers. And the older I get, the more it has sort of stayed with me. I mean, I think the thing that I took away from being raised as a Quaker were absolute nonviolence and the simple idea that makes so much sense to me, that there should be no intermediary, nobody interpreting your experience of God for you, no minister or priest or rabbi. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I think I'm one of the there are a lot of Catholic actors. There are a lot of Jewish actors. All these religions that have a lot of, you know, the bells and the smells and the, you know, the incense and the lights and the drama. There are very few Quaker extroverts.
Are you one of them?
I guess I am. I guess I am.
So will you be watching the season finale of The West Wing tonight?
Yes. Actually, I do not watch all the shows because it makes me squeamish, but this one I will watch because this one, and I'm not saying this to promote it, but this at the table read was an incredibly emotional thing. I think it's a fascinating, risky episode, and Tommy Schlamme, who is our producer who directed the episode I did where Josh freaked out with the shrink, directed this episode, and that's always makes it special.
And is it relief to know that you're ending this season without having to get shot?
Well, you know, you better watch the episode.
Right.
It could happen again. Yeah.
Well, Brad Whitford, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Brad Whitford plays Deputy White House Chief of Staff Josh Lyman on the NBC series The West Wing. The season finale airs tonight. Our TV critic David Bianculli has seen tonight's episode, and he has a review. Just to recap, President Bartlet, played by Martin Sheen, is preparing to go on national TV and tell the country he has multiple sclerosis, something he's kept secret for several years. The big question central to tonight's episode is whether Bartlet, after revealing his illness, will step down, complete his first term, or announce his intention to run for re-election.
If my TV viewing had to be cut down to one show a week, The West Wing is the show I'd pick. Why? TV, like film, is a collaborative art. To achieve greatness, you have to have great players on the entire roster. And on the West Wing, there are no weakest links. Writer-producer Aaron Sorkin serves up strong scenes and stronger episodes. The way he writes this series, the whole ends up being even greater than the sum of its parts. The direction is magnificent, and the actors, well, they're an all-star team. Every element of The West Wing is invested with such care that it's a show you have to watch closely to keep up. But if you make that effort, you'll be amply rewarded. Casual viewers who watch TV while multitasking or making refrigerator runs may mistake tonight's show as another end-of-season cliffhanger. But if you pay attention, the answers are there. A year ago, remember, Sorkin ended The West Wing by having the president and his staffers be attacked by sniper fire. The cliffhanger aspect was who was shot and how seriously. It turned out the most seriously wounded was Josh, a West Wing staffer played by Bradley Whitford. And while playing out that crisis, Sorkin also presented a series of flashbacks showing how all the characters, including the president, wound up working in the White House. It was a technique that let us know more about the characters and how they related to one another, even as they were undergoing a major crisis. Tonight's episode certainly ranks high on that crisis scale. In addition to the president's MS revelations, there's the democratically installed ruler of Haiti hiding for his life in that country's U.S. embassy. There's a major tropical storm headed straight for Washington, D.C., a political battle to be fought against tobacco company lawyers, and the funeral service for Bartlett's dear, sweet, smart secretary, Mrs. Landingham, who died suddenly at the end of last week's episode, killed by a drunken driver. In the midst of all this current activity, Sorkin again uses the same bold technique from last season and flashes back to deepen our knowledge of the characters and their relationships. This time, we meet for the first time a college-age Bartlett, introduced to a much younger but no less feisty Mrs. Landingham. The roles are played by different actors than their modern counterparts. But by the time those scenes are through, you understand the anger with which the president responds to his secretary's sudden demise and his own current problems. Immediately after her funeral service, and only hours before having to address the nation, Bartlett asks the Secret Service to seal off the cathedral and give him some time alone. As soon as the doors slam, he begins walking down the long aisle towards the altar, talking to God like one major power speaking frankly to a much greater one. Bartlett is furious, and portraying him, Martin Sheen is fabulous.
You're a son of a bitch, you know that? She bought her first new car and you hit her with a drunk driver. What? Is that supposed to be funny? You can't conceive, nor can I, of the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God, says Graham Greene. I don't know whose ass he was kissing there, because I think you're just vindictive. What was Josh Lyman, a warning shot? That was my son. What did I ever do to yours but praise his glory and praise his name? There's a tropical storm that's gaining speed and power. They say we haven't had a storm this bad since you took out that tender ship of mine in the North Atlantic last year. 68 crew. You know what a tender ship does? Fixes the other ships. Doesn't even carry guns. Just goes around, fixes the other ships, and delivers the mail. That's all it can do. Gracias, Tibiago Domine. Yes, I lied. It was a sin. I've committed many sins. Have I displeased you, you feckless thug? 3.8 million new jobs, that wasn't good. Bailed out Mexico, increased foreign trade, 30 million new acres of land for conservation. Put Mendoza on the bench. We're not fighting a war. I've raised 3 children. That's not enough to buy me out of the doghouse. Hey, Craig,
that's only one intense moment from a show filled with them. And if that doesn't convince you that The West Wing is as good as TV gets, then I'm not sure anything will.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, film critic Henry Sheehan talks to us from the Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ The Cannes Film Festival in France, the biggest and most important film festival, started 1 week ago and ends on Sunday. Henry Sheehan, who reviews films for Fresh Air, is at the festival. He went to the Radio France studio at the festival to talk with us about the films he's seen so far. This is Henry's first time at Cannes. I asked him first what the atmosphere is like.
People tell me it's subdued. It seems fairly hectic to me. The festival got off to a very glitzy bang. There was some worry that there would be a lack of stars because Hollywood ratcheted up their production schedules in case there had been a writer's strike, which there won't be, or an actor's strike, which I guess there still could be. So a lot of stars who might have come over here to make the scene or promote a picture are not here. But there was such a big to-do over Moulin Rouge, which was the opening night. It's a... You know, it was a remarkable event. The usual opening screening with black tie for the men and the women in gowns. And then the studio, 20th Century Fox, erected this large building on the waterfront, three different rooms, all done in the decorated very elaborately in the style of the movie, which takes place in Paris in 1899. And, there was dancing. Nicole Kidman, who, of course, is the star of the movie, was there with the rest of the cast, but Nicole Kidman was really flashing her charisma. She DJ'd for some of the dancing, and they had the lined can-can dancers on the front steps of the Palais, which is the main building for the festival, to kind of salute her with their legs as the screening began. And then afterwards, at this post-screening party, the dancers changed into scantier costumes yet and performed for the guests. So it was kind of, you know, La Dolce Vita right here on the Riviera.
What's the point of all that? I mean, obviously it's to sell the film, but how is this kind of, party and spectacle supposed to help sell the film?
Well, in this case, it's helping to open the film. Moulin Rouge is a very... different kind of picture. It's a weird hybrid. Like I said, it takes place in 1899 in Paris, and the director Baz Luhrmann has gone to a great deal of trouble building these huge sets and also using computer animation to make us think that we're actually back in that era. But at the same time, this is a musical now, mind you, and all the songs are from the 70s and 80s. Madonna's Material Girl, Your Song that Elton John had a big hit with, and Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is a big number for Nicole Kidman. So it's a kind of an oddball production, and being a musical, musicals don't do too well. So it has to say, before you hear of it in any other way, the studio wants you to hear that it's special, that it's big, that it's glossy, that it's star-driven, and it puts people in a certain frame of mind for the film. So I think from a marketing point of view, you can set the picture of your picture for the public.
It sounds like Moulin Rouge is the most hyped movie at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Did you like it?
Well, it's an extraordinary experience to watch the movie. I mean, literally, I have not seen anything like this before. I mean, it's set in Montmartre, and it's been recreated beautifully in these long shots. It looks like he's had his camera set up near the Eiffel Tower, and he's looking on the hill with Sacred Heart on the top, and the red windmill of the Moulin Rouge, and then in the sky, instead of just a regular moon, there's a moon with a face and a big mustache. For what's a romance, Ewan McGregor plays this young English writer. Nicole Kidman is a dancer with star ambitions at the Moulin Rouge. And, they fall in love and have the usual troubles with dreams and the realities of life. It's for something that's supposed to be very passionate on a very simple level, it's very artificial and very cold. So it's not a movie I came out of feeling terribly moved, but I have to say I was pretty impressed.
Another film I know you've already seen at the Cannes Film Festival is David Lynch's new movie, Mulholland Drive. And Lynch, of course, is best known for films like Eraserhead and Blue Velvet, and he did Twin Peaks. Tell us a little bit about this new movie. It's his first in several years, isn't it?
Well, it's the first one since The Straight Story.
Right.
And it's, but this is a much more like, I would say, in tone and in structure, kind of the Twin Peaks movie. Although it's, I think it's better. It's very strange in a way. I mean, the last 45 minutes is very strange. The first hour and a half, it's just under 2.5 hours, is kind of like this accessible and easily to follow kind of mystery thriller story that seems to be going somewhere, but it only you slowly begin to realize that its plot manipulations, that its logic are all very dreamy, and it's not really heading in the very specific directions towards the solution of a mystery that you expect.
Todd Solondz has a new movie called Storytelling. His film Happiness, I thought, was really terrific. Have you seen the new one yet?
Yes, the Todd Solondz movie was one of the hardest movies to get into a screening of. It's not showing in the competition. It's in the uncertain regard section. And like a lot of Solondz movies, it attracted many cheers, but some vociferous boos when the screening was over. It's a two-part movie. The first part is, I think, one of the best things he's ever done, about a young woman in a writing course and the sexual experience she has and how she writes about it, and that's called Fiction. And then there's the second part is a longer series about a documentary filmmaker played by Paul Giamatti, who makes a movie about a kind of a slacker type in New Jersey. And there's some autobiographical elements, obviously, there. Giamatti's been made up to look very much like Solondz himself. I thought the second half didn't work as well. But like I say, the first part, which is only about 15 or 20 minutes, may be the best thing he's ever done.
What's the best movie that you've seen that you haven't yet mentioned?
One of the most interesting films in the festival is by Manuel de Oliveira, Portuguese filmmaker who was born in 1908 and who has been extremely busy. Over the 90s has been like his most fruitful decade, and he's going into the next century just as busy. This movie stars Michel Piccoli as a stage actor who comes off stage to find out that his wife, his daughter, and his son-in-law have all died in an auto accident. And he's been left alone with his grandson. And it's a very odd movie about him trying to put his life back together. And there's some very funny, if very dryly comic, sequences to it. Now, Michel Piccoli is, you know, he's not in his 90s like Oliveira, but, you know, he's an elderly man. He's well into his 60s. And he's hired to play, an American director played by John Malkovich hires him to play Buck Mulligan, a young man, in this weird screen version of Ulysses. And it's while he's trying to do that, that kind of all the tragedy in his life begins to emerge through this weird performance, this bad performance this French actor has to give as a young Irishman. And with Oliveira's films, you tend not to want to describe them to people because they sound so bizarre. But this is a very self-controlled movie that turns out to be extraordinarily moving. And I would bet that Piccoli would get Best Actor based on what I've seen so far. And the movie itself could well win a prize, too, as could Oliveira.
My guest is film critic Henry Sheehan. He's joining us from the Cannes Film Festival. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Henry Sheehan is joining us from the Cannes Film Festival in France. He reviews movies for Fresh Air. you're getting to see films from around the world at the festival. Are there any films from other countries that you'd really like to single out so if they come here, we'll hopefully remember them?
Well, Iran continues to be a terrific source of filmmaking, tremendous filmmakers there. Abbas Kiarostami, who did The Taste of Cherry, which won the grand prize here, I think it was 2 years ago, might have been 1 year ago, was here with a very strange movie called ABC Africa, in which he went to Africa into Uganda at the request of a group of women who fund orphanages to do a film on their work. And instead of making a conventional documentary, he used these very lightweight, very portable video cameras to show us the children who are orphaned and just show us. And it's remarkable what you can feel about other human beings just watching them, especially children at play. And I don't think, if it wasn't, normally I'm not very, you know, high on video technology, but if it wasn't for these lightweight, inexpensive cameras, Kiarostami could never have made this film. And it's a tremendous, I don't know, it sounds corny, but it's a tremendous reaching across from one side of humanity to another. And it's a very light film in a way, but it's a movie I hope opens in the U.S. The other one was by another leading Iranian filmmaker called Mohsan Makhmobef, called Kandahar, which was not a great film. It's about a woman, an Afghan woman, trying to get back and sneak back into Afghanistan because she's got a letter from her sister telling her that she's going to commit suicide. She's so depressed. But when you find out that the woman playing the woman in the film is not an actress, but an Afghan refugee living in Canada who got a letter from a friend saying that she was going to commit suicide because she was so depressed, and not knowing what else to do, she went to Makhmobef and asked for his help, and he came up with the idea of making this movie. Then, you know, something that looks like maybe special pleading, something that looks like a too heavy-handed a message movie, suddenly looks like a very piercing look into the way life is actually lived in a great part of the globe.
What do you think the contenders are so far for Best Film?
Well, for Best Film so far, I would have to say No Man's Land is probably a competitor. You have to think about the jury at the Cannes Film Festival, and this jury is headed by Liv Ullmann. The president of the jury wields enormous influence over the jury, and she's a very serious woman who, you know, feels that films should comment on the human condition. So there's a film from Bosnia called No Man's Land that would probably be at the top tier of these angry war movies that come out of the former Yugoslavia. And I would think that she would be interested in that. The Coen brothers have a movie here, The Man Who Wasn't There. They're very well liked here. Of course, they won for Barton Fink. I didn't like the movie. It's a kind of James M. Cain-ish thing starring Billy Bob Thornton, but the character he plays is so passive. I found it a very hard movie to relate to, but you know, they definitely have their following here. There's no question about that.
Do you trust your reactions to the films you're seeing at the festival? Do you think you might respond to them differently at a press screening for three critics in your own hometown, or going on a Saturday night with an audience?
Well, you know, that's something, you know, that you believe that you come to control over your years of being a critic, and I've been doing this, I guess, for more than 20 years now. So, you know, you do credit yourself with your ability to modulate your reaction to the atmosphere, to how many, you know, to whether you're seeing it at 8:30 in the morning or 8 in the evening, whether you're seeing it with two or three people or whether you're seeing it with a very enthusiastic crowd. Naturally, that's foolish to think that you've completely mastered that, so you have to be aware that you may be susceptible to that. I actually went back and saw the David Lynch movie Mulholland Drive a second time because I'd been so enthusiastic about it after I saw it the first time, and people asked me to describe it, and I felt I was describing a much inferior movie to what I had seen. So in fact, I just came back from seeing it again before this taping, and I'm more convinced than ever I was right the first time. So
the movies that you're seeing now, do you know when the rest of us will get to see them?
Well, Shrek and Moulin Rouge are opening across the United States this month. Moulin Rouge is limited May 18th and goes wide on June 1st. Shrek goes very wide very soon. The other movies, it's very hard to say. You know, it's very strange what movies get picked up here. Like, for example, the Lynch movie, Mulholland Drive, does not have an American distributor yet. But an American distributor did pick up a very strange vampire movie by Claire Denis, the woman who directed Beau Travail. It's called Trouble Every Day. It takes place almost entirely in Paris. It stars the American actor Vincent Gallo. It's half in English, half in French, and it's about people who apparently have taken some kind of narcotic that has permanently affected their sex drive. That is, their sex drive has become extremely powerful, and at the moment of orgasm, they start biting their mates to death. Obviously, they don't make love with one another. And that movie, man, that got snapped up right away. I you know, to me, it looked, you know, not like the easiest sell in the world. But there are other films here, you know, very frankly, I don't know. Le Pianiste, a Michael Haneke film with Isabelle Huppert as a Austrian piano teacher who becomes or tries to become involved in a sadomasochistic affair with a student. I only think that will open in the United States if Huppert wins Best Actress here, and then they can sell, you know, the film on that basis. Because I don't think, you know, otherwise movies about sadomasochistic piano teachers are just going to do all that well, even with an art house audience. Huppert gives an extraordinary performance. I would have to say she's the leading candidate for Best Actress here. And I would say if it wins, you will see that sometime before the next Cannes Festival, sometime over the next year.
Well, Henry, I want to thank you for talking to us from Cannes.
Hey, it was my pleasure. I hope the caffeine was working well.
I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thanks. I'm sure I will.
Henry Sheehan reviews films for Fresh Air and the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Amy Sallet, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an inside look at the rise and fall of an internet startup company. We talk with filmmakers Chris Hedgerus and Jahan Nujaim about their new documentary, Startup.com. Hedgerus also co-directed The War Room with D.A. Pennebaker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.